not sit and wait. Just do it on your own. Otherwise, you're going to lose everything you have.
Community Solutions for Coastal Erosion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, smaller scale timber lumber companies might get a shot at Big Thorn Timber.
There's a fairly significant number of small operators on Prince of Wales, and these projects have been set up specifically for them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Burgess today denied the state of Alaska's request for a stay in his decision overturning Alaska's same-sex marriage ban. The Alaska Dispatch News reports Burgess' denial means same-sex marriages in Alaska can continue. Corey Mills with the State Department of Law told ADN the state plans to now ask for a stay at the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. An appeal in the case, which could potentially overturn the decision, will also be filed with the Ninth Circuit. The state filed notice to appeal the decision on Monday. Same-sex marriage in Alaska began Monday, a day after Burgess ruled Alaska's same-sex ban to be a violation of due process and equal protection clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Arguments have been scheduled on the federal government's request to dismiss a lawsuit over the Interior Department's refusal to allow for a road from King Cove to an all-weather airport at Cold Bay. Government attorneys say the decision by Interior Secretary Sally Jewell was reached after 5 years of environmental analysis and public outreach. They say Jewell wasn't obligated to approve a road, and her decision is owed deference by a federal judge. The state joined the city of King Cove, tribal governments, and individuals in challenging Jewell's denial of a road through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge that could improve access to emergency flights. Arguments on the motion to dismiss are set for Monday in Anchorage. The Forest Service plans three more timber sales in a part of Prince of Wales Island conservationists say needs to be protected. They're much smaller than a recent sale in the same area. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The sales are between Thorn Bay and Kaufman Cove on northeast Prince of Wales Island. They're part of the larger Big Thorn sale area, which is tied up with court challenges. Officials recently sold nearly 100 million board feet of Big Thorn timber to Viking Lumber, Southeast's largest mill. Tongass supervisor Forrest Cole says the three smaller sales total less than 5% of that amount.
There's a fairly significant number of small operators on Prince of Wales, and these projects have been set up specifically for them.
The smaller mills, some part-time businesses, have lobbied the Forest Service for sales they can afford to bid on. Cole says the goal is to keep them operating.
They are larger than typical sales that they deal with, but the concept for these projects is similar to the Big Thorn, to try to get a longer-term amount of wood available to the smaller operators.
Several conservation groups have sued to block sales in the Big Thorn area. One is Greenpeace, where Sitka's Larry Edwards is Alaska Forest campaigner.
We think that the whole Big Thorn sale needs to be set aside and the legal matter decided before any sales are made at all.
Others involved include the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, the Alaska Wilderness League, the Greater Southeast Alaska Conservation Community, and the Center for Biological Diversity. They say Big Thorn sales will hurt deer and wolf populations. Governor Sean Parnell's administration has filed to become involved in the legal battle. The state fears the Forest Service will not adequately defend its decisions. While the sales are designed for smaller mills, Cole says there's no guarantee they'll get the trees.
Everybody can put a bid in on it. These are being put out as timber sale contracts, so highest bidder wins. Given that the larger operator just picked up about 100 million feet, we suspect that there would probably be less interest there and more interest by the smaller operators.
The Forest Service estimates the three small sales value at about $750,000. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A coalition of environmental organizations are criticizing the state for issuing a coal mining permit for a site near Palmer. Alaska Department of Natural Resources issued a renewal of a permit for Yosebeli Coal's proposed Wishbone Hill mine on October 3rd. The Mat Valley Coalition issued a statement on Monday expressing disappointment in the move. According to the coalition's Liz Allard, the state is ignoring the wishes of Alaskans.
In 2011, DNR hosted a hearing here in the Valley where over 200 people turned out in opposition of the Wishbone Hill mine. And then you fast forward to earlier this year when Yosebeli was seeking their air quality permit for a third time, and over 500 people submitted public comment in opposition to the air quality permit, only to have the Department of Environmental Conservation approve the permit in June.
Yosebeli Vice President of Business Development Rob Brown said in an email that Yosebeli acquired the permit in 1997 and has maintained it and the coal leases since then. Yosebeli began the permit renewal process for Wishbone Hill in 2011. Brown says the Wishbone Hill coal is slated for export to Asian markets from Port McKenzie. A feasibility study completed in 2011 was based on producing 500,000 tons of coal annually. The Wishbone Hill permit has been a source of contention among area residents for several years. Allard says the population of the area has grown since 1991, and some homeowners in the area complain of health hazards from coal dust to children and elderly, while an elementary school operated by the Chickaloon tribe is close to a road access to the proposed mine. Supporters of the mine say it will provide jobs for the community. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an old Alaska Native survival tool is being put to use on a new state-of-the-art research vessel.
I found it was pretty universal tool within the coastal communities that spend a good portion of their life out on the ice with the subsistence hunting and all.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
As climate change brings new threats to subsistence communities across Alaska's coastlines, a conference held in Anchorage is advocating community-based solutions and not waiting any longer for government assistance. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
The 7th Annual Northwest Tribal Water Rights Conference wrapped up on Friday in Anchorage. This year's focus was on how climate change is eating away at the shoreline across rural Alaska and how communities there are taking matters into their own hands. Hal Shepard directs the Center for Water Advocacy, which organized the two-day event held at the Pioneer Schoolhouse. He says the nonprofit organization is broadly focused on water issues, emphasizing specific concerns raised by tribal partners.
Probably the most pertinent issue right now in Alaska for Native Village communities is coastal flooding and erosion. So that is causing some villages are considering moving the villages because it's a safety issue. They get these huge waves and inundation from the seas.
Presentations touched on the Norton Bay Climate Change Adaptation Plan, which Shepard says is the only comprehensive strategy he knows of for dealing with current environmental changes in coastal Alaska. The plan offers a dramatic shift in how communities deal with the interwoven hazards of erosion, worsening false storms, and destructive flooding. In the last few years, communities like Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Newtok have had halting starts and stops, coordinating site relocations with the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies. Now, Shepard and others are stressing, don't hold your breath.
We really try to emphasize, again, the tribal focus on managing their own resources and the ability, not only the expertise, but the legal authority that tribes, we believe, have to do that because they're the most impacted by climate change. It just makes sense that they're the ones that should take the lead in managing resources to protect their communities.
For examples of how that looks on the ground, Shepard and others point to the communities around Norton Bay in the southeastern pocket of the Seward Peninsula. Terry Johnson with the University of Alaska recounted Shaktulik's ongoing construction of a coastal berm to protect homes from storm surges and flooding. After years of paying outside consultants and waiting for agency plans to develop, residents there took it upon themselves to start filling mounds of driftwood with sand, gravel, and local grasses. It's hardly a silver bullet for climate change, but Shepard says those are the kinds of creative engineering solutions to hyper-local problems emphasized in the Norton Bay Plan.
Everything from building, you know, encouraging beaver, who are some of the most expertise hydrologists we have, in building beaver dams and controlling flows, natural flows of water.
Rose Kalistuk works for the Oritsararmut Native Council in Bethel and represents the more than 200 tribes in the EPA's Region 10 area covering Alaska. She says it's not just government agencies that are failing to help with mitigation efforts.
Especially when it comes to climate change and coastal erosion, the villages are losing their lands. The native corporations which own the lands have not done anything. They have not moved forward helping the villages.
Like the approach laid out in CWA's Norton Bay Plan, Kalistuk's advice for going forward is clear.
Do not sit and wait. Just do it on your own. Otherwise, you're going to lose everything you have.
Many of the presenters and visiting officials at last week's conference are preparing to rehash issues and solutions around climate change in February at the Alaska Forum on the Environment back in Anchorage. For KSKA, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has released its summary report for the 2014 commercial salmon fishing season. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, continued low king salmon numbers and new management tools were at the heart of this year's fishing.
The total number of sockeye salmon caught by Upper Cook Inlet commercial fishermen was down this year, some 20% less than the 10-year average. But at about $2.25 per pound, some $35 million worth of fish were still harvested. That dip in sheer numbers caught doesn't have anything to do with the run strength of sockeye, but rather the lack of run strength for king salmon.
The Chinook salmon, the king salmon, everybody knows, came back again in 2014, pretty small runs.
That's commercial fisheries manager Pat Shields. Under new rules approved by the Board of Fish for this year, restrictions put on in-river fishing for kings had to be reflected in similar restrictions for the commercial fleets.
So when the sport fishery went to a catch-and-release fishery, starting on July 1, the commercial set net fishery started the season with no regular periods and then a maximum number of hours of 36 that could be fished during the year. And the department attempted to use those hours to maximize sockeye harvest and to stay off of kings as much as possible.
That was the big point made during those winter meetings with the Board of Fish way back in February. Let's target the sockeye when they're on the beach and then back off. And while this move was somewhat satisfactory, or at least a step in the right direction for in-river users wanting more kings, the sockeye hunters were worried about over-escapement, letting too many fish back up the river. And those concerns weren't without merit. The Kisilof River saw record or near-record returns on several days throughout July, and widespread use of the Kisilof River Special Harvest Area, better known as the Terminal Fishery, continued this year.
An imperfect tool. You can use any analogy you want. You know that we're taking a crescent wrench to rebuild a motor, but it's really the only tool we have to try to keep the sockeye escapement down in the Kisilof River, and then we use the drift fleet extensively to try to harvest as many sockeye as we can out in the middle of the inlet, and because they're a very minor harvester of king salmon.
The terminal fishery at the mouth of the Kisilof was actually designated for a totally different purpose. Originally, it was only supposed to be used when Kenai River sockeye numbers were down, the thought being the commercial fishers could hit the Kisilof until more reds came in further north. But now, and for the past few years actually, it's being used to let king salmon pass through, though new genetic testing tells us that a few Kenai kings get picked up there too.
You know, you put that all together in your basket of management options and you mix it all up, and it doesn't come out very pretty, but it's really what we have to deal with this inequality that we have right now, poor king runs and good sockeye runs.
Shields says concerns about overescapement on the Kisilof weren't limited to arguments heard during the Board of Fish meetings. They came pretty much immediately after the season began.
In the Kisilof sockeye run this year, from day one, put us in a box between a rock and a hard place that we really didn't want to be. And what I mean by that is there was a large escapement early, from the very beginning. They showed up strongly. So we figured out pretty early in the season that we likely were going to escape that system, not because we wanted to, but because of the large run that was coming back early and strong.
And in fact, both the Kenai and the Kisilov rivers saw sockeye runs exceed their hoped-for return numbers by more than 300,000 fish in the Kenai and about 100,000 in the Kisilov. The late-run Kenai kings hit the lower end of their escapement goal, with approximately 16,000 fish coming back. Just 5,300 made it back in the early run, and commercial fishermen also took in about 2,000 king salmon in 2014. The Board of Fish is scheduled to take up Cook Inlet issues again in 2017, but will be lobbied hard to move some of that work ahead this week. There are 9 out-of-cycle proposals for the board to hear about when it meets for a work session later this week in Juneau. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the historic Anchorage Hotel, offering amenities such as continental breakfast, 24-hour concierge service, and Wi-Fi. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The man who oversees all of the rural campuses of the University of Alaska Fairbanks has been touring those campuses since being appointed to the job back in July. Yvonne Peter visited the Bristol Bay campus last week. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
Yvonne Peter is the new Vice Chancellor for Rural, Community, and Native Education. As part of that job, Peter's in charge of the College of Rural and Community Development. That includes all of the UAF rural campuses. Peter says the campuses serve a vital role.
A lot of work happens in rural Alaska, and there's a lot of opportunities for us to train and educate our citizens, especially our young people, to be able to fulfill positions within all of those different industries, both in the private and the public sector that exist out here. And so just for that reason alone, they're critically important.
Yvonne Peter is himself a graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in Alaska Native Studies in 1998.
I returned after finishing my bachelor's degree to run one of the rural campus centers for the university. And so my professional career began with the UAF. And after serving in that role for a couple of years, I moved home to Arctic Village and served as a chief for my tribe there, and really started to learn what the challenges are that our people face in a small tribe.
As part of his new job, Peter is tasked with championing the importance of higher education for the rural residents of Alaska. He says one of the goals is to start that higher education process as early as possible.
One of the areas that are emerging right now, and that has already been for a while, is early college, is providing opportunities for our high school students to be able to take college courses, receive credit both at the university level, but then also at the high school level, because a lot of our students are ready for it. And it provides them that opportunity and a clear pathway for them as they finish high school to continue on into post-secondary education.
The entire University of Alaska system has embraced the use of distance learning technologies, and nowhere is that more evident than the rural campuses. Peter says it's crucial for the university to use these new tools to reach students at or near where they actually live and work.
We have the early e-learning center at UAF that's really in the process of delivering a lot of course load. And it's the largest growth area, actually, of our student body and credit hour count within the university system is in e-learning. So people are tapping into the mechanisms of being able to use the internet, use audio conferencing, use different forms of technologies to be able to really offer educational opportunities at the community level.
Yvonne Peter has only been on the job as the new Vice Chancellor for Rural, Community, and Native Education at UAF since last July. And last week's visit to the Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham was his first visit in that new position. In the coming months, he plans to visit all of the rural campuses and learning centers in the College of Rural and Community Development. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Conducting research at sea in Arctic ice-filled conditions is a tricky endeavor, requiring a host of high-tech gear. But on the University of Alaska Fairbanks' new ice-capable research vessel, Sikuliak, at least one piece of equipment dates back generations. KNOM's Jen Ruckel has more.
In a few months, the ice-classed research vessel Sikuliak, owned by the National Science Foundation, will be equipped with about a half dozen Arctic-native ice testing sticks as part of the ship's safety outfit.
It's a multi-tool. Sometimes there's a hook on the end for retrieving stuff. The other end is used for poking the ice. It could be a harpoon with rib bone or some type of bone sticking out on the other end, again, to test the ice. Obviously, if it goes through, you don't want to step there.
That's Brandon Amasik, subsistence director at Koerik. He says it's a highly valued safety tool for Alaskans who live in coastal communities and venture onto the ice for hunting in the winter. By testing the ice in their path with the stick, they can prevent accidentally falling through the weaker patches. Amasik says his family always takes this tool with them on the ice because of its many functions.
If you do happen to fall through, hopefully you can catch yourself before you fall past your waist and pull yourself back out. If you do happen to fall all the way through, it's still there to where you can pull yourself up, like doing a pull-up. So yeah, again, it's just a safety tool. They almost always have a dual function, whether it's a harpoon, a retrieving hook, mooring hook.
Amasik says, fortunately, he's never fallen into the water himself, but he's seen it happen to others, and it can be pretty terrifying.
One of my brothers did fall in, and he said immediately it just took his breath away. He couldn't breathe. I mean, within seconds, you know, he's able to pull himself out. A lot of times, individuals that are out seal hunting, walrus hunting, they're miles and miles from the nearest town, village. You know, so I mean, if you do fall in, you know, you're going to be soaking wet. More than likely, you're not going to make it back to wherever you came from because within a matter of minutes, hypothermia is going to set in and then you're going to be froze to death.
The Sikuliak is not an icebreaker, but it is an ice-classed vessel capable of breaking through up to 2.5 feet of ice. The vessel will operate in ice during some of its research missions in the Arctic, and scientists may be walking out on the frozen sea to collect data samples, which means they must be prepared for potentially dangerous situations. Daniel Oliver is the Marine Superintendent at UAF Seward Marine Center. Oliver was in the U.S. Coast Guard before taking his current job, and he said it was through visits to coastal communities aboard Coast Guard icebreakers that he realized how functional and necessary the tool is. After consulting with NOAA's Marine Advisory Agent, Gay Sheffield, he decided to request those ice testing sticks as safety tools for the Sikuliak.
I found it was pretty universal tool within the coastal communities that spend a good portion of their life out on the ice with the subsistence hunting and all. And, you know, from talking with a number of the folks from the villages, it certainly made sense to me, which is why, when we were looking at what we were going to carry on board Sikuliak for equipment, having this capability aboard made sense to me.
Perry Pungawi is a craftsman in Savoonga, a member of the National Science Foundation Sikuliak Oversight Committee, and alternate commissioner on the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission for Savoonga. Pungawi will be making the sticks with materials that Sheffield and Oliver have sent over to St. Lawrence Island. He says the tools are, quote, time-tested by ice walkers of Alaska. Oliver says he hopes someone from Savoonga, who is part of the ship's science oversight committee, will be able to join the Sikuliak crew at some point during ice trials in order to share knowledge about the ice testing sticks and Bering Sea ice conditions. The Sikuliak is homeported in Seward, and it will be used by U.S. and international scientists. Its first funded science trip this fall will be in the Western Hawaiian Island chain. Reporting in Nome, I'm Jen Ruckel.
About 5% of Juneau's population identifies as Hispanic. Some are non-English-speaking immigrants who need help translating official documents or government forms. Others require assistance navigating the Alaska court system. A national nonprofit that started a Juneau branch last year now offers Spanish translation and interpretation services in Juneau. KTOO's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Eddie Reyes helped found a Helping Rock, now based in Florida. After he moved to Juneau, Reyes started a local branch. He says government agencies like the Division of Motor Vehicles had not provided many Spanish language services in the capital city.
Because there's not maybe an interpreter or they don't understand the language there to fill out a form, suddenly someone had to walk out of there without a picture ID. Because, of course, if you're going to try to get a job, you have to identify yourself. Well, how do you do that if you have no ID?
Reyes says Piedra de Ayuda is made up entirely of volunteers. Since last year, the local branch has added 7 board members and helped about 20 different clients. Although the law requires courts to provide interpretation to people with limited English proficiency, nonprofit and commercial organizations that offer language assistance are rare in Alaska. Neil Neesham is court administrator for Southeast. He says 60-70% of interpretation is done over speakerphone, which is not always the best option.
Now, obviously, it's more effective to do it in person only because you get to see subtleties such as facial language, hand language, intonation, and those sorts of things.
One recent client, Piedra de Ayuda, is a Latin American woman who needed to go to court for a protective order against a man she met in Juneau. We've omitted her name due to the ongoing nature of her case, which involves accusations of domestic abuse and sexual assault. The woman moved to Juneau a few months ago with her boyfriend. Soon after arriving, she says she met a local man who seemed well-connected, knew the area, and offered guidance. She says the man helped her find an apartment, although at the time he was homeless. The woman claims he asked to live with her family temporarily, and that's when things went downhill.
El martes fue muy buen hombre.
She says Tuesday he was a good man, Wednesday he was a good man, Friday he was a good man, but Saturday he was a monster. She claims he was often drunk and abusive. Friends advised her to go to the police, but she was reluctant.
Tenía miedo.
I was afraid, she says, because I said, what if he kills me? What do I do? Because he said he was going to make me disappear. She ended up at Piedra de Ayuda, where Wanda Peña took her case.
She didn't know her way around and basically was harassed by this man because of the lack of the language. She couldn't communicate with anybody, so she ended up going to the courthouse, and they provided her with our number, and she immediately called.
Peña helped the woman fill out paperwork and interpreted for her in court. The woman says she's grateful for the services Piedra de Ayuda provided.
Ella me fue a ayudar.
She came to help me so quickly. They didn't charge me anything. They were wonderful people. In Juneau, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld and Kayla DeRoche in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Jen Ruckel in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at Alaska.BP.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.